to found in our home some unpublished sermons by Jim Elliot. And so I'm going to use the introduction to one of those as my introduction today. It was given in April 1, 1951, significantly April Fool's Day. At the time, those of you who remember those times, as some of us don't, there was a Senate Crime Investigation Committee that was going on in the Senate, and they're investigating interstate commerce that was done illegally. And it was basically, it was a investigation on organized crime. And as they, and they, so they brought some of the heads of the crime, organized crime families into the Senate to ask them questions. And as they got more and more into it, they realized that the committee had found all kinds of corruption, not only in organized crime, but in government and all of that. And so this is what he's addressing. He says, in the past few weeks, the Senate Crime Investigation Committee has uncovered a shocking amount of corruption among the elite and respectable of American society. With careful, objective probing, this committee has undressed some startling evils and laid bare before the eyes of the already overly shocked public the stark naked reality of treachery, bribery, and organized lawlessness among the higher-ups unparalleled in our history. This was in 1951, by the way. At one hearing, a woman was being interviewed about what she thought of all this investigation. She said that she thought it was a good thing and it might ought to be kept up, that it ought to be carried on right down the line, that the little grafters ought to be checked up on as well as the big-time ones, and that the investigation ought to reach down right down to her own husband. Happy Valentine's Day. Few of us have such an honest spirit as this woman. There's something frightening about her suggestion. For what if someone did come and begin checking up on us all? What if all the events of my life, of which I'm ashamed and which I have carefully tried to bury, should be dragged out into the light of public scrutiny? Does not the embarrassment that I feel just thinking about it reveal the secret shame of my heart and the sense of guilt that I have in facing my sin? Oh, that they may not be really bad things, rather insignificant as we look back on them, but all the same, we just assume nobody came around forcing us to reveal them. But wait a minute. If these secrets of my past are disturbing to you, what must they be to God? Can he have forgotten them? Does he pass them off so lightly? Can his holiness disregard even the slightest trespass of his inflexible law? Never. Whether there's been a thought of wickedness or an outright act of sin done in the secrecy of darkness, God has marked it and will require an account of it. Nothing has escaped his eye and nothing has been dimmed in his memory. He will bring to light the hidden things of the heart. He will manifest the secrets of darkness and will openly disclose the motives that have been in the minds of men. It was Jesus Christ that said, there's nothing covered up that will not be uncovered, nor secret that will not be made known. Because what you have spoken in darkness will be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in people's ears behind closed doors will be proclaimed from the housetop. There is in God an investigation committee weighing the works of every man, judging his motives, considering his inmost heart. You, listener friend, are at this present moment under the careful scrutiny of the all-searching eye of the Almighty. He knows you thoroughly, more intimately than you know yourself. Do you know what he thinks of you? Would you like to hear his decision about what he sees within you? Thus comes the words of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet. The heart is deceitful above all things and just desperately wicked, exceedingly corrupt. I, the Lord, search the mind. I try the heart. There it is, God's discovery right there inside of you. Deceitful above all things, desperately wicked, exceedingly corrupt. Have you agreed with God in this judgment about yourself? Do you know the deceitfulness of your own hearts? Or are you arguing still, hiding in that warm little harbor of self-respect, defending yourself against the charges God is laying upon you? Dare you longer disagree with him who knows you better than you know yourself? Turn from your pride, your independence, your self-sufficiency. Turn and acknowledge your sin. Repent. Agree with God. That's what the book of Romans addresses. That's the reason for the book of Romans. Because of our heart. Because of our sinfulness. And the first part talks about his, about our sinfulness, as Jim has described. And talks about who we are apart from Jesus Christ. And then he talks about the justification that he provides. And my favorite phrase is in Romans 8:1. Therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ. That accounting has taken place and has been placed on the shoulders of Jesus Christ. And after that, as we take on that, as we realize the mercies of God is what the phrase that Paul uses in verse 1 of chapter 12, as we take on it and realize what God has done for us, and it changes the way that we live on a daily basis. We're in Romans chapter 12, verses 9 to 13, and I'm almost embarrassed to preach this sermon because it's so straightforward. I mean, just bam, 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 and it doesn't really need any explanation. So we're going to do it anyway. But you look at that and you say it's just some very obvious things and obvious things that we need to be looking at in our lives. So let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoice in and hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. Are there any of those you don't understand? Kind of straightforward, isn't it? The first one is let love be without hypocrisy. I think there's probably a lot of hypocritical love that was expressed yesterday. Valentine's Day, here's your card and I love you and this kind of stuff. And I think along with that is some hypocrisy that took place. In our insert this morning, there's a definition here of love. It says no strings attached. The Greeks had a word for loving, forgiving kind of love, which never excludes. They call it agape, and the gospel writers the New Testament writers have taken that and packed a lot of meaning into that. And in that, he says, Edward Nason West gives this definition of this agape love, a profound concern for the welfare of another without any desire to control that other or other person, to be thanked by that other, or to enjoy the process. It's love, she puts it here, it's love with no strings attached. It's the ability, it's a self-sacrificing love that doesn't ask for love in return. And in our world, when we talk about love, usually we talk about what we can get out of it, not what we can put into it. And I hear it regularly, well, I don't love them anymore, so therefore I'm not happy and I don't love them. And so that gives me excuse to get out of a relationship or out of marriage. So love in our day has become very self-serving. And they say, so if I'm not happy in this relationship, what's the point? The point is you're there and God has asked you to love that person and to care for them and to cherish them. Hypocrisy, you know, if it's hypocrisy, we're talking about this in our small group, that if it's hypocrisy, it's not really love. You know, you can express love hypocritically, but you don't show it hypocritically. So love without hypocrisy is a love that doesn't have acting. That word hypocrisy is a word about acting. It's not a love that you're acting as you're demonstrating it, but it comes out of the heart. It's not being something that you are not. The second one is abhor what is evil. That word abhor means to hate intensively, or carries with it the idea of to shudder at evil. it just kind of, you know, that just, it just hurts. It goes against my grain. It's the opposite of love. Someone has said the only security against sin is to be shocked by it. Are we shocked by evil? We are around it so much and we see it so much that it gets to the point where we're no longer shocked by it. I was talking to a teacher this week and they said in the classroom, and this was with younger kids, that there's so much profanity that's spoken in the classroom. And it's justified as that's their expression. That's the way people talk. And she's not allowed to put a stop to it. And you look at that and you say, now wait a minute. We get so used to the evil and we become so absorbed in it that it gets to the point where we begin to justify it. So I got some cough drops this morning. And my cough drops are wrapped up in these little things. And it says here, it's a pep talk in every drop. So here's some, here, dust off and get up. Get back in the game. You've survived tougher. Don't wait to get started. Conquer today. Here's one that says, inspire evil envy. I thought, no, wait a minute. Inspire envy? So be the Joneses that everybody else is trying to keep up with. It's kind of live your life so that other people look at you and be envious. Now, wait a minute. Is that really abhorring evil? Where does that come from? And we get so used to it in our lives and in our society that we get so we're not shocked by it anymore. And I'm guilty of that. Goes on to say, to cling to what is good. That word clings really means to have glue. Get glued or bounded to what is good. To look at the good. The good is not just something that's nice. It's something that's inherently right or worthy. And he says, take those things that are good, and he says, cling to them or be bound to them. So on one hand, we abhor evil. On the other hand, we cling to what is good. And we're part of a society that wants to, that tries to redefine the words of what is evil and what is good. So it takes that which is evil and wraps it up in words, in nice sounding words, and it defines it as good, and takes that which is good and wraps it up and defines it in terms that makes it sound evil. I mean, something as simple as creation. This is creation Sunday, we're told this morning. So you look at that and you take evolution and it's wrapped up and packaged in such a way that it sounds like a really good thing. And if you believe it, you're enlightened and you're smart and you know what's going on, even though it's still a theory that hasn't been proved. And you wrapped up it. And then you take creation, and if you believe in creation, you're a Neanderthal. So it takes that which is evil and makes it sound good, and takes that which is good, it makes it sound evil. Like, who in their right mind would think creation? To the point where you can't even have an honest debate about which is right and which is wrong, and what are the pros and what are the cons about it. So he says, look at what is, and we do that, and you know, what we watch on TV, the things we read, the billboards, the movies, all that kind of stuff. And in the what's going on in our heart, sometimes we allow evil to be a part of it and we don't cling to what is good. Then it says to be devoted to one another in brotherly love. That's almost a redundant phrase. The Greek reads Philadelphia philostrogoi. That same word is in both, the philos is in both words. Philos is a family type of love. It's a tender affection. And it's in both of those words. The be devoted is the word for that. It's wrapped up in that. And it's wrapped up in a love that goes with that. So it's a family love that's not based upon attraction or desirability. The reason for that, for family love, is you can't choose whose family, what family you're in, do you? You know, I tell people, I'll meet somebody and ask them, boy, this proves that you can't choose your brothers or your sisters, can you? And because we're put in a family, and there's some exceptions, but we're put in a family, and that's the family that we're supposed to draw together in love. And so he says, you're put in a family, love those people, show devotion and affection to those people because you're part of the family. You may not choose them, you may not, they may not be your best friends, but you're committed to them because you're part of your family. And both of those words have that family love relationship in them. The Philadelphia, of course, talks about the brother or the family. That's the kind of love we're to have. But the other, the storge, talks about a tender affection or a friendship love. That's the kind of relationship we're supposed to have in the family of God, is what he's describing here. So even in the church, we're here together and we function together. And we're told here, Paul tells us here, we're to have be devoted to one another in brotherly love. We're supposed to care for one another because we're part of the family of God together. And I would say that that expands beyond just here. It expands to the family of God worldwide. So that we don't slay Christians from other denominations or other church groups or other belief structures within the church of God. That we have a commitment to one another, even though we have differences in theologies and differences in practice, as long as we're together in the family of God and hold to the orthodox doctrine of God together, we're supposed to have be devoted to one another in brotherly love and the joy of that fellowship together. And that hasn't, many times that has not happened in church because we're out there slaying one another instead of showing love. Jesus said they'll know we're Christians by what? That you, because you love one another. And I look at the world and they look at the church and they say, man, I sure don't see a whole love between Christian groups. And we need to be realizing, we need to be careful how we speak with, of one another and to one another. And how we present one another, even our differences, that there should be a love, a devotion to one another in brotherly love. Next one says to give preference to one another in honor. It's not to take preference from one another or to demand a preference, but to give preference to one another. This comes from a humility. And if we're really devoted to one another, this will be a natural response to that. As we begin to have an appreciation for others, as we begin to honor one another, lift each other up. And a lot of times in our self-indulgent society, we think, you know, what is it in me, and do I get the attention that I need? Does everybody look at me? And we need to be looking at that and saying, how can I give preference to other people and to honor them as Christ has honored them? Next is lagging behind in diligence. The Christian is not to be slothful. We need to be intentional in the use of our time and use of our resources so that we don't get caught up in just wasting time. And oftentimes we can do that. We can waste days and days and days. And he says we need to be diligent. Not lagging behind in diligence, but to be active and to be disciplined in the life that we have. Next one is fervent in spirit, to have an enthusiasm about what God is doing. And we have different personalities, and some exhibit enthusiasm more than others. In terms of their personality, but we need to be thinking of the things of the Lord and be concentrating on that. Paul writes elsewhere, let us not lose heart in doing good. That we need to recognize that we need to be, in our spirit, need to be enthusiastic about what God is doing and what God can be doing through us. Serving the Lord, this gives a different perspective of life. The enthusiasm and serving the Lord should go together. And we need to see our serving of the Lord as a part of our whole life and not compartmentalized. So I'm not just serving the Lord when I'm here in this building, or serving the Lord when I'm doing outside, or we're serving the Lord when we're teaching Sunday school. You know, those are all a part of it, but the broader part of that is our life. In verse 1, he says, "Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." Everything that we do in life is a part of our serving the Lord. So when we go to work, we're serving the Lord. We're not there just to make a paycheck. We're there to serve the Lord. When we're in our neighborhood, we're there to serve the Lord. When we get together with friends, we're there to serve the Lord, and not, you know, not a holier-than-thou carry a halo around type of thing, but recognizing that we're having an impact in people's lives for the Lord wherever we go and however we go. And so the total use of our time, our abilities, our resources are a part of serving the Lord in our lives. We need to be careful that we don't compartmentalize our life. Next one is rejoicing in hope. I told the story to the group on Tuesday night, and I'm going to repeat it here. On Monday night, I went to a class, a perspectives class, and I sat in on Dr. Matt Hennessy was the teacher of it, and he's the pastor of Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church, an African American pastor in a predominantly African American church. And he told this story because he had talked some about race relationships and that, and in the context of the perspective class. And he quoted a professor of Harvard who was asked one time if he's optimistic about the future of racial relationships, mainly between whites and blacks in America, and that there would be an improvement. And this was that professor's answer. He said, "I'm not optimistic, but I am a slave to hope. I'm a slave to hope." And when we look at our world and we talk about abhorrent evil, we talk about the evil that is around us and all the things that are out there that we just shake our head at and we wonder about, sometimes it's difficult to be optimistic. But Christ said, or Paul is saying, we need to be a slave to hope. We need to recognize that God, in the midst of all that is going on, is doing his work. And at little corners, in little places, with people, God is doing his work in the midst of all the evil that goes on, not only in our country, but in countries around the world, some of which whom have it a lot worse than we do. And in those countries, you see God using people and working in and through people to bring about the kingdom of God. And so in the short stand, we can say we're not optimistic. But he says we need to be slaves to hope. We need to recognize that God is doing his work, and he's headed for a plan, and we're headed with him. And let's not get wrapped up in things around us that are discouraging, but to realize that God is doing his work, and he wants us to be a part of the work that he's doing. That brings us hope. That brings us the ability to get up every day and say, "God, how do you want to use me today? What difference you want to make in my life and through my life to other people?" Next is persevering in tribulation. It's hanging in there when times get tough. It's a testing that brings growth. And it's going through difficult times that God is using those times to help us to grow. And God places challenges in our life and allows difficult things in our life because he knows that through those difficulties, we will grow. Through those difficulties, we will get to the end of ourselves and begin to rely on him. I read someplace that there was a father who had a child who had been in, was a very challenging child because of some mental illness and some things that were going on in the child. And they had this perfect family and everything had been fine. And he said, "God, allow this to come into my life," because he knew this is something I could not control. And I knew I would need him in the process. And when this couple found out about the child, you know, she was not a believer. He had strayed from the faith. And as they started to deal with this, they began to realize we need God to help us through this. And they came back, she came to the Lord, he came back to the Lord, and they realized that through this, God is the one who gives strength to persevere through the trials, to keep on moving in the times of tribulation, and that we need him through those times. Next is to be devoted to prayer. Paul instructs us elsewhere to pray without ceasing, to recognize that prayer is our avenue to call upon God for the help in the times of need, and for simply the communication of our relationship to him. He says we need to be thinking through. It's the breath of life to us, a spiritual breath of life. And it's the secret to many of these other commands where we begin to ask God, help us, help me to be devoted to one another, because sometimes I don't want to be devoted. Help me to give preference to one another, because sometimes I don't want to do that. And it's the power that comes to help us to work through these other areas of our life. Next is contributing to the needs of the saints, and this is very straightforward, becomes very practical. What are some things that I can be doing to minister to the needs of people around me, in this case, it's to the saints? So you look at the family of God, people that God has put us in, what can I be doing to minister to those needs? And we often think of money, and that can be a part of it, but a lot of times it's not a part of it. A lot of times it's a phone call, it's a card, it's a let me help you move, it's those kinds of things. Contributing in very practical ways to the needs of those around us. Then the last one is practicing hospitality, pursuing the love of strangers. Sometimes we think of hospitality as being those that who put out a fancy meal and the person that can give the nicest meal and that kind of, you know, they're the person who has the gift of hospitality. That's not it. It's opening your home. In fact, the word means the lover of strangers. And oftentimes when we think of hospitality, we think of inviting in people that we know. Really the word here, it's like you contribute to the needs of saints and show hospitality to strangers. And do we do that? Do we bring people into our homes to give them a step closer to not being a stranger, to be a part of our family, our home? Hospitality in many places has become a lost art. And we need to be willing to open our hearts and open our homes and open, and it doesn't have to even bring them home. Sometimes it's taking them out for lunch or something where we're caring for people, we're reaching out to people, we're loving them and caring for them. Now I want to have a little bit of an open discussion here. Where we interact. What I'd like you to do is, these are very practical commandments, and I'd like for you to give illustrations from your life or from people that you know. I don't want any names named, no names, but things that you have seen in a practical way that are an illustration of these things in your life or in other people you know's life. So we're not doing names, because that's not the point. The point I'm wanting to know is for us to get an idea of the kinds of things that fit into this in a very practical way, because this is a very practical lesson. So what are some of the things that you've observed or seen or been a part of or been receiving on the receiving end? Most of you won't want to say, well, I got up and I did that. Well, that's not giving preference to others. But anyway, but things that you have seen that have been a very practical expression of these things that we've listed this morning. Would anybody like to share?